if I say all the men in the regiment went out one day, and the youngest was the only one that didn't return. Historians write things like that, or journalists. That's a factual thing. But packed within that is the resonant question of why do the young die? Do the good die young? Or every fact can have resonance. And that's why what I like about poetry. The other thing I like is it's condensed. The whole world often will explain an explanation and they'll argue about an explanation. They'll give another. Listen to the discussions on the Ukraine, or listen to the search for the missing plane. It went this way, it went up, it went this way, our machine, this and this. And somehow or other, poetry kind of lofts up almost like some of those big winged birds, like a blue heron. They might be a little clumsy starting, but then they start up and fly up into another realm. And that's what I like about poetry. It crosses realms. It's a border crossing activity where you don't use a lot of prose and pseudo sociology and psychology to cross the border. You just plain cross the border.
The themes that you write about in Buoyancy's your collection of poetry, you're really writing about the same things that you have in your cultural histories and the other books that you've done. These are the same themes, but you're doing something a little bit differently. As you mentioned, you can maybe discuss these things in a different way and bring out different aspects of, for example, you write a lot about yourself getting older and your family and even golfing, as you mentioned.
You're on the target, and completely on the target. I'd say, I don't know if to go through the order you said and add the last one, but surely I'm always concerned with death. Some people sing for love, and that's their poetry is love poetry, and others sing over human fragility, transitory qualities. You're here, you're gone. And a lot of poets sing one way or another, this was today, but tomorrow. Or this is today, but what about yesterday? So remembering family, that's very large to me. Just memory, remembering family, how I might be remembered and put my last niche in mind. Although mind isn't a permanent, it's not a total safety deposit box. Some of the things that neighbors are about, a friend and I in one of the poems took an arborvitae out. Mm-hmm. And it was quite a thing. The truck was up on its, well, it was front wheels were off the ground. It was like a prancing horse. And finally we yanked the arborvitae out. And just with the name arborvitae, you have a built-in metaphor, the tree of life, arborvitae. So I do like that idea of everyday things. Like I had a neighbor named Virgil who went to World War II, and somehow or other he worked in Los Angeles, and just on the edge of Los Angeles he helped with cows. And just that idea that this Norwegian guy who was so distinctly from southwestern Minnesota is in Los Angeles, a soldier, but somehow or other, I don't know the connection now, but he's taking care of cows. That kind of stuff doesn't get out of my mind easily. And poetry is a way to surface what's in your mind. It's there hammering and pounding at doors. And once in a while, if you write a good poem, and you use the right word, you open the cellar door and out come all kinds of things and people. And
with some of the people you write about, a family, and the last poem in the book deals with one of your favorite uncles.
Yeah, that's my Uncle Bill. And the poem to him called Buddy Afloat was the poem that I sent it to the Italian Americana. And right away they said, well, take it. We really like this poem. And he was my favorite uncle. He is the uncle. I loved all my uncles, but this one in particular I took to heart. And I was just old enough to be taken along with my grandfather, my mother, and maybe his, my mother's sister. Bill had signed up early, just after Pearl Harbor. My grandfather made us line up and salute him. And then I had to be part of the automobile procession that delivered him somewhere downtown Detroit on a main street. And then he was going to be go to Great Lakes. So that's one part of the story. And then he went there and he trained to be a medic's assistant. Then they put him on a refurbished passenger ship and turned it into a troop ship. And he delivered all these young soldiers to North Africa, which is in many ways the first phase of the American Army in World War II on the land, is in North Africa. And they discharged their troops. They went behind the wiring that was supposed to protect them. A German sub got in behind the wiring, torpedoed his ship, which had a terrible name of irony, Bliss. It was called Bliss. And it sunk his ship, and his ship died a terrible death, long, slow, agonizing. And very early in the evening, he took his friend overboard with him. His friend was dead, and then he kept his friend afloat till the morning, till rescue, and raises all these profound questions of, was the friend actually keeping him afloat? Was he keeping the friend afloat? Was he too loyal to let the body go? Was he too afraid in the darkness to let the one familiar thing he knew go? I mean, it's just, it's maybe all that. Then Bill got married just about the time he left the service, and he didn't come back to Detroit to our family. He took his new bride and went to Boston, actually Malden, got a kind of a terrible job at a bakery. He's up at 3 a.m. baking rolls. But the significant thing was Bill, my Uncle Bill, ended up living in the upstairs apartment of the widowed mother of the buddy he kept afloat. In other words, he was still clinging to the friend. And I went back. I was part of the redemption trip to bring Bill back to Detroit. So that's a very long poem. I'd read you the last stanza if you want.
Yes, please.
I'm going to just read you the very last stanza, say of 15 stanzas before. And now, a half century later, what seems a flood of time ago since the trip of reclamation with my beloved grandparents Bill and Francis long gone and my very own Joe and Ethel and even Bill and Margaret dead, I keep them together and afloat in the dispersing seas of time. I do this with the buoying grace of memory and the treading kick of word and story. So that could be considered one of the cores of the book.
It's Joseph Amato reading the final stanzas to A Buddy Afloat, one of the poems in his book, Buoyancies, A Ballast Master's Log, it's subtitled. And that concept of buoyancies, that's very much connected to that last poem. Is there a deeper metaphor involved there with the buoyancies, keeping yourself afloat, keeping memories afloat, keeping life going, all those sorts of things?
Yeah, that's wonderful you asked that. In this case, insofar as water can hold you up, of course, water can take you down to the black depths, or water can turn into one of my favorite terrifying metaphors, black ice. Mm-hmm. But water can hold you up. Water can bring life up. And water, to a degree, can be like the air in your lung. It can be the lightness of a beautiful young person where they appear to be off the ground. We heavy people who've gotten old, we clop. In fact, the word for shoes are kloppen in Flemish, I think. We clop. were clodhoppers, were heavy. Even the word clodhopper in contrast to light. But the deeper element there is, what is it that graces our mind, even when we're old and heavy? What is the breeze, the current, the stream that enlivens and lightens the mind and sends it up beyond itself? And of course, if grace is one form of buoyancy, one of the great buoyancies is hope. Finally, we hope. And that's what we're going. And well, thanks for the question. It helps me even talk about what I'm thinking. That's one thing about this poetry. It often gets me in the muddles, and muddles of metaphors and thoughts and desires. And then almost I have to think about what I wrote. Mm-hmm. To yet get beyond what I wrote, or not beyond it, but to fully embrace what I wrote.
One of the things about poetry as a reader, in comparing maybe having, if you had written that story or some of these stories in prose, is that there's room to breathe in poetry, and there's room to, after reading the poetry, or even line by line, to just take a breath and let it and absorb it a little bit. And I think for that reason, there's more of an intimate quality, maybe even more memorable, that these images stick with the reader longer.
Yes, I think it allows you to take flight. A few good words allow you to take flight. Long prose, even when it's well spoken, unless it's carefully crafted, and sometimes prose turns into poetry that way, actually hogties you. A concept here and a set of statistics there and a somewhat an argument here and a therefore there, even though it's a fake therefore and a so. And all of a sudden the soul is almost partitioned and tied. And so poetry should be light. I don't mean shallow or superficial in the bad sense of the word, but it should be light and ready to take flight. And that's why Proverbs are good. I want to say I say this in every conversation, every time I get a chance, but my favorite Sicilian proverb, or Italian, but it's actually in Sicilian, is this: le cose lunghe diventano serpente. And that is, anything, it literally says, long things turn into serpents. And it means anything that gets drawn out or long constricts you. And instead of, if it's a long business affair, you can be sure at the end you're liable to get screwed. to use a vulgarism. Anything that's long, if it's a long book and it's too long, it's certainly going to snare you in tedium. Whereas poetry can be quick, like a dart, efficient, quick. And in my deepest sense, poetry should be buoyant. Now, if I could, I'm making my own transition here.
That's fine.
Buoyancy is the lift in the book. But a ballast master, maybe your audience wants to know, what the hell is a ballast master's log? Well, which is the subtitle. And a ballast master's log is, first off, a ballast master, you've got to think about the Eastern Mediterranean. You have to go in your mind back to the Romans or Greeks or even Egyptian sailors. You have to realize their ships did not have deep keels, and you have to realize they capsized very easily. Big winds, high waves, but above all, a shifting ballast in the hull of the ship. So all that olive oil in the amphorae, the waves go up and it rushes to one side of the jugs. All the jugs create wherever you go. So next to the captain, the second most important person at keeping a cargo ship afloat. It'd be like if you had even a freighter today and you had a bunch of big trucks and tanks on it, or large, heavy cargo, and the rope snap in the hull. You could capsize a ship with that shift of weight. So the now, when you get older, you've taken all this stuff into the hull of your being. I'm speaking metaphorically, but it's in your mind. It's actually even in your bones. You got a lot of ballast. And as you get through life and you start to approach death, you kind of want to prepare that final trip of this or that. And I write at the last line of the first poem, if I can. Then I'm all through, Carl. I promise not to keep turning everything into a length. But I write at the last poem, which picks up the religious flavor of the poems, if I can find it here. I'll read the last three stanzas. I'm just choosing.
And this is the Ballast Master.
From the Ballast Master. And this is from as Uncle Bill was the conclusion, so this poem is the beginning. I'm old. I'm thinking about going to sea for the last time. I now stand by for all times. I return to creating waters. With only the weakening kick of treading memory, I go to sea. But if you put your ears to my chest, you'll hear my lungs inflate with weightless ballast of buoyant, airy hope. And look above, on the highest rigging, is the emptying Christ of cross and the fresh catch of carrying winds. So there's an Easter quality to buoyancy. We get out of the ground.